Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. In 2001, soon after George W. Bush was inaugurated, today's guest, journalist David K. Johnston, called the White House press office for comment on the latest IRS income data. The deputy spokesperson expressed disbelief at the official figures he read. So David asked, "What do you think is the median income shown on tax returns in America?" The press officer's answer? $250,000. The actual figure at the time? $28,000. In his new book of columns and articles about inequality, David K. Johnston writes, "Misperceptions about affluence and poverty continue to infect our politics, even as the massive chasm that divides the very rich Americans from everyone else has become the defining story of our time." He points out that nearly 95% of all income gains between 2009 and 2012 went to the top 1%, while the vast majority, the bottom 90%, saw income shrink by 15%. Income inequality is now higher than it was in 1928. But David points out that it doesn't have to be this way. Change is more than possible. We can choose to restore broad prosperity instead of promoting highly concentrated prosperity and deepening poverty, especially child poverty. The question is, how can we do this? Today, we are joined by David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and editor of the new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. David is president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors, a grassroots nonprofit dedicated to improving the quality of investigative reporting, and he teaches at Syracuse University College of Law. And David joins us from WXXI Studios in Rochester, New York. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Well, glad to be here. By the way, I'm now the past president. My term at IRE, which has 5,000 members, ran out.
Oh, thank you. Actually, you were in studio last time when you were attending the conference.
Yes, our annual conference, and that was the end of my 2 years.
That's right. Well, okay, so past president. So, David, this story that you tell, I think, is really interesting and eye-opening and says a lot in the opening of your introduction about when you spoke with George W. Bush's press officer and asked what is the median income shown on tax returns, and the answer was 250 grand. How surprising was that to you?
Well, it was surprising because the person who said it had previously worked in the Treasury Department as a political appointee, so I thought they would have a better understanding. But the reality is if you're at a high-level position in the federal government in Washington, you're only surrounded by people who make a lot of money. Friends of mine who own businesses that do things like, you know, metal bending and plastic injection molding and sort of traditional industry things, of which we have a fair number in Rochester, they all understand the inequality. But when you talk to people who are in finance, even the secretaries in the finance companies are well paid, so they just simply do not see it. It's not part of their lives. They're not hiring from the pool of people who are in the bottom half of the income pile.
Well, you also point out that people with a lot of money are increasingly living in a world that's closed off to poverty. For example, private boxes now in sports stadiums, gated communities, private jets, different hospitals and doctors for the wealthy. How does this affect public opinion about what we're really facing?
Well, at the high end, it insulates people, and many of these people are unaware, by the way, that these things that separate them are heavily subsidized by the government. 80% of the cost of the new stadiums built in this country in the last 20 years came from the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. Private jet travel is subsidized in numerous ways that I have documented over the years from the official record. So, not only are we separating ourselves as a society, and here I'm talking about the very top, not even the 1%, but the tenth of 1% and above from the rest of society. And it's important to understand that the top tenth of 1%, Rose, that's 300,000 people. So we're talking about a minority of people who live just in San Francisco, or the top tenth of 1% in America. Mm-hmm. They make as much income as roughly the bottom 140 million Americans.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and then also talking about the divide, What are your thoughts on journalists today and the talking heads? Because journalists now make, well, I mean, I'm talking about television for the most part, but they're making eight figures. How does this affect their reporting on these issues? Because I do notice that when someone brings up inequality or a real life situation on the ground, it tends to be glossed over.
So yeah, this is a real fundamental problem. When I started out at the San Jose Mercury in 1968 as a staff writer, 19-year-old staff writer, the newsroom was full of people who came from the backgrounds around the Bay Area. And today, newsrooms, even in many newspapers, are full of trust fund kids. I mean, I know several New York Times reporters whose fortunes or family fortunes are in 8 and 9 figures. That is more than 10 million, more than 100 million. On TV, when Katie Couric was the CBS Evening News anchor, her annual pay was larger than the combined budgets of Morning Edition and All Things Considered on NPR. And naturally, that has to affect how you see the world. And even low-level people you see on cable TV shows, they all have black cars that drive them back and forth to work. When I'm a guest on those shows, they send a black car to get me if I'm in New York City. It alters your perception about these things. And I think it is a real fundamental problem, particularly that we have many, many journalists, especially journalists covering Wall Street, who grew up in very affluent homes and therefore reasonably tend to look at the world and go, gee, things seem pretty nice. Hmm.
Well, and you're in a really interesting position because you go on these shows to talk about these issues. So what's your experience has been like in trying to not only raise awareness about this, but to also say it doesn't have to be this way? There are solutions.
Well, this is actually a little saddening. If you're on with someone like Ed Schultz or Rachel Maddow or Lawrence O'Donnell, all of whom are wealthy, they have a real understanding of these issues, and they try to present them in a balanced way, certainly with a viewpoint, but they try to have a rounded view. When I'm on with somebody like John Stossel or John O'Reilly, Bill O'Reilly, there is this, I guess I would describe it as contempt for people who don't have money, this super Calvinist on steroids view that money is an indication that God or society or nature has blessed you, and not recognizing that, in fact, there are powerful structural aspects to this that limit people's ability to get ahead. You know, I live in, I was born in San Francisco, but I have lived in Rochester, New York now for the last 21 years, and I just left the annual luncheon of our community foundation, which my wife is the head of. Luckily, got to walk out after her talk. And one of the things that she talked about was that the city of Rochester has the third highest concentration of extreme poverty in America. By a bunch of other measures, it's in the top five of poverty. And yet, this is a community that has multiple billionaires in it. The wealthiest school district in New York State is 1.5 miles from the poorest district. And people don't interact. And this is a real problem. It's very easy in our society to not notice. If you live in Los Angeles and you drive a car, you can drive up and down the Harbor Freeway and be totally unaware of the extraordinary poverty in Compton and Watts and Paramount and East L.A. And East L.A. if you go further north.
Right. Or Skid Row, for example, where people are living in tents along the sidewalks. I remember when I was in L.A., I think it was last year, I asked a lot of people if they'd ever been there, maybe a 10-minute drive, and they hadn't.
Right. Yes. And when I worked at the L.A. Times many years ago, I once took an editorial page writer to some of the poor neighborhoods to show them the reality of what was going on. And the thing that most struck that particular editorial page writer was there were houses that had bars on them. Basically, people were living inside a prison, and there were others that didn't. And they said, why is that? And I said, well, the people in the ones that don't have bars have nothing, and the people who live in the ones with bars have a little that they are protecting from being predated. And it was like just eye-opening to this person who was used to, spending their time on the west side of L.A. and living a very nice life because they came from a prosperous background.
I'm speaking with journalist David K. Johnston. He's editor of the new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. He is the winner of a 2001 Pulitzer Prize for uncovering loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. David, you often talk about the structural reasons when you look at how we got here, and you can't really describe how we got here in a quick soundbite. So how do you do it in a way that's palatable for people to really understand? Because, I mean, you've got so many numbers in your introduction, and they're all really shocking, but I find that it's sometimes hard for people to wrap their arms around these numbers.
Well, I can show you schools in the United States that are all white and schools that are all black that perform awfully. And the most common characteristic between those schools, and based on my observations, are that the parents and grandparents live in a culture where their attitude is, what did education ever do for any of us? Whereas many children grow up in homes where, you know, at the moment of their birth, their parents are figuring out how to develop their minds, paying for extra lessons, taking them places to see things, making sure they go to art museums and develop a sophisticated understanding of the nature of art because it helps you understand the world. And so those parents can invest in their children and they see results. There are other parents who they don't have any resources to invest. Society has withdrawn resources. And predictably, they grew up with a different viewpoint about, well, what good is it to particularly work hard? If you only can look at jobs rather than a career, your attitude is sort of, when is the clock hit 5 o'clock so I can get out of here?
Mm-hmm. Where do you see that part of it going? Because, I mean, we've done a lot of shows, many with you, about the fact that today, it's a very service economy, and so people are not making very good wages, and they don't have health care, and forget about retirement. I mean, this is kind of the new norm. Where do you see this going? Do you see it changing anytime soon?
Yes. I mean, I think we're seeing change in a lot of places. We're seeing minimum wages being raised. Remember, the minimum wage, when I was a minimum wage worker before I went to the San Jose Mercury in 1966-67, is about $11 in today's dollars. We're seeing that when San Jose raised the minimum wage, people didn't quit going to restaurants in San Jose and drive to Los Gatos and Santa Clara, which are neighboring cities. They continued to eat in those same restaurants. We still don't have universal health care, so we're spending $2.64 per American on health care for every $1 that the 33 big competitors we have in the world spend for universal care. That cost and the damage that does to economic growth in time should be pushing us towards a universal health care system that will be more efficient and less costly. And I think the crucial thing to change here is people standing up and saying, this is a democracy. We make the rules. The rules we have are not creating the society we want to live in. We don't want to live in China or Mexico or Venezuela or Brazil North. We want to live in a country where people have opportunity, where crime is minimal because people have sufficient incomes, and where the human spirit can flourish.
What do you think about the actions that we've been seeing over the past few years, the actions to increase the minimum wage, the fast food workers, Walmart workers are still either walking out of the store or at least letting people know about, you know, just what they face on a regular basis, trying to make ends meet. So many of them are on food stamps because they can't. But this is a massive growing movement. What do you think of it?
These things all take time, and it's not going to be an even path. But we are seeing that a number of cities, you know, Seattle has taken the lead in this and moving toward a $15 an hour minimum wage. You know, it was only 7 years ago that President George W. Bush, with the support of almost all the Republicans in both the House and the Senate, passed a law raising the minimum wage. Now, many of the lawmakers who are still around who voted for it are saying, we need to get rid of the minimum wage. Well, people who make under 20, I write a column once a week for Al Jazeera America, and I did three of them analyzing the new wage data from Social Security and showing that between 2000 and 2012, people who made under $20,000 actually got a small real increase in pay, and it's because of the law that George W. Bush signed with the support of Republicans. The group above them, 20,000 to 40,000, that's people who make basically $10 to $20 an hour, their pay went down a little bit. They don't have unions, and they are a little worse off And by the way, 77% of all the wage gains in America went to a very narrow class of workers, the 7% of workers who make $100,000 to $400,000 a year. That's where all the wage gains were, which says a lot about the value of education and having a career rather than a job.
David K. Johnston is editor of the new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And David is often on our show talking about how the media cover these issues, and then also what are some of the structural changes we need to see to deal with inequality. And if you have any questions or comments for David, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. What really strikes you about what we're facing today? And if you have any questions for David about all of the things that have contributed to this, globalization, the outsourcing of jobs, attacks on unions, there's so many different things that have contributed to this issue. If you have any questions about that or you'd like to talk about where we go from here, you can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Carmel in Santa Cruz. Hi, yes. Carmel. Welcome to the show.
Okay. I've always thought, and I know it's probably not a possibility, if some of these companies and corporations would speak out and take the high road, if everybody in the top three layers took a little cut and raise and their pay, they'd still be rich. I mean, how many homes can you own and yachts and private jets? Give everybody from the bottom up a raise. That would get the economy going. It would help all these people who are working. It would get them out of maybe working two or three jobs a day just to live. And they're going to do the high road because they're Americans. This is our country. Why can't we just get the ball rolling like that? Why can't they just do that? You know what I'm trying to say?
Yes.
Well, yes.
David?
Oh, sure, Carmel. Well, in fact, you know, in the early 1970s, particularly when we had the brief recession in 73, 74, it was very severe and very brief. There were CEOs, back then we called them presidents, who announced things like they were not going to take any bonuses or they were going to cut their own pay until everybody was put back to work at the companies. That changed when Jack Welch became the head of General Electric and got the nickname Neutron Jack because he fired, if I recall correctly, about 100,000 GE workers. It was certainly tens of thousands of GE workers, and went around basically boasting about that to the point where there are movies now that have lines that, you know, talk about the cackling CEO, fire another 500,000 people. So we've had this cultural change where at the very top of companies, this idea exists that the purpose of the company is only to serve the shareholders. That's not what the law says. That is not what the historical practice says. And if corporations don't recognize that they have broader social obligations to the communities that tax themselves to provide the roads and the sewers and the separate freeway off-ramps and whatever else they need, to the workers who spend their lives with those companies or large portions of them, there will be a negative reaction to that. So it's certainly in the interests, I think, of those people at the top to improve pay. And let's remember that as pay improves, aggregate demand, that is the ability of people to buy goods and services, goes up. Walmart is in trouble. Walmart is not making its numbers and hasn't been for several years because its clientele, who are toward the bottom end of the income ladder, they don't have the money even to buy Walmart stuff. Hmm. And McDonald's has caught itself in this dollar menu deal where there aren't much in profits. So they actually have an interest in raising wages to their own workers and to others so people have more money to spend on their goods and services.
Well, thank you for calling in, Carmel. And let's go next to Andrea in Santa Cruz. Hi, Andrea. Hi, do we have Andrea? Nope, we lost Andrea. And Andrea had a personal story. If you get this, Andrea, you can give us a call right back. David, what else are your thoughts on CEO pay? How much attention do you think that this one deserves? Because late last year, CEOs broke their pay record. The top 10 earners took home at least $100 million a year each, the first time this has ever happened.
total jobs at the top, $2 million and up pay jobs, actually have declined. They're down about 5% since 2000, and the average wage is down about 4%. But at the very, very top, the CEO jobs, the stratosphere keeps being pushed further and further up, and it's because we have a set of rules for corporations that encourage this behavior. We can change that. Congress can alter the rules. I don't like the government micromanaging how much people get paid, but if we're going to pay people $100 million a year and there's no social utility to it, we can also reasonably say we're going to take 70% of that in taxes. And if that happens, if we went back to these very high rates on very high incomes, I'm talking about, let's say, over $25 or $50 million a year, one of the things that would then transpire is a board of directors would be faced with, I'm sorry, you want another $10 million and we're going to give $7 million of it to Washington to give you three? I think we can find better places to put that money to work. The public pension funds need to be more active in challenging this, and so do investor groups, because the share of corporate revenues that are going to high-level executive pay has been rising, and that means that returns to the shareholders, whose money, after all, the executives are paid to take care of, has been slipping.
You also write about what life was like before 1970. And one of our producers was born after that. And she said, for my generation, the generation that just graduated from college, they can't imagine a life without massive inequality. So what would you say to that generation about what life was like before then?
Change it. When I'm 65 years old, when I was a young man, nobody that I knew who worked and was sober had any trouble finding work and decent paying work. This wasn't nirvana. I don't mean to say the world was perfect. We were lots of problems we had. But today, you know, people are desperate to find work. Why? Because we've set up a whole system of rules in our society that discourage employers from hiring, that have moved good-paying jobs overseas in order to make a little arbitrage. And there's some big shocks that are coming. And let me give you a simple example of that. And I realize you're San Francisco, not L.A., but, you know, Southern California's economy is highly dependent on the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. Well, there is a 100-square-mile rail yard that Al Jazeera is about the only news organization that's written about being built on the border about 50 miles west of El Paso. It's on both the U.S. and in Mexico. And it appears that China and Singapore and Japan and the other countries we import from are looking at having a huge port built in Mexico where they can pay much lower wages and move all that business around the United States into Mexico. And, you know, we need to have public discussions about the rules that we're operating under and how we promote and build commerce and jobs and stability, not the focus we have, which is on how do we get the rich more money? I mean, the rich won't invest in jobs if we don't give them more money, which is absolute nonsense. But it is certainly what drives Washington if you just turn on C-SPAN for a week and watch it.
David, 30 seconds to break. What is the status on that port? Who's making this ultimate decision?
Oh, the Mexican government and the importers, it's the rail yard that really needs to be looked at now. I mean, one of the things that strikes me just thinking about it is if you have that big a territory under private control, if you're worried about drug smuggling or other illegal activity, whoa, wait a minute.
David K. Johnston is editor of the new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. He's the winner of a 2001 Pulitzer Prize for uncovering loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. He also writes a column about these issues for Al Jazeera America. You can find his work at yourcallradio.org. Growth at the top has become so concentrated. The top 1% now possess 40% of the nation's wealth. And income inequality is now higher than it was in 1928. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
And we're taking a moment here. Me, Matt Martin, general manager of KALW, Becca Hoekstra, producer of Your Call, asking for your support in the midst of this conversation with David K. Johnston, the kind of voice you hear on your call, someone with deep knowledge, who does the research, who also has a commitment to asking how we can make things better. That is what your call is about, and your support right now at 800-525-9917, or your click on the Donate Now button at KALW.org. We'll keep this conversation going.
The number to call is 800-525-9917, or donate with a click at KALW.org. For $120, David K.'s new book, which he has edited, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, can be yours. A $120 donation gets you this book, which provides an incredible overview just of all of the ways that inequality is impacting us in like healthcare, social mobility, political representation, education. It hits all of those areas and provides a great primer for talking about these issues.
We are wrapping up this membership campaign tomorrow at 6 p.m. We want to make it a success. If you are listening now, do not wait to give to KALW to support this conversation. We won't be back asking for your support until May of 2015. So your call, listeners, this is a participation show. This is a participation station. Your support right now will keep all of that strong. You are the fabric of this station. Make a call at 800-525-9917, KALW.org. You have the power, as we push toward this goal, to make sure this station is strong and we can bring you more of these vital conversations. The number to call, 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Look at thank you gifts. We're not interrupting the programming, so we don't take time to talk about those. Your support at 800-525-9917 keeps us strong. Thank you so much.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be joined by Tavis Smiley to talk about his new book, Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are speaking with David K. Johnston, an award-winning journalist. He won a 2001 Pulitzer Prize for uncovering loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. In his new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, he points out that federal income tax payments for the nation's 400 top taxpayers have dropped by 60% since 1961, while increasing for everyone else in America. And his book is just full of statistics about what we're facing right now, the fact that income inequality is higher than it was in 1928. But he says it does not have to be this way. There are many solutions. So if you have any questions for David about these issues and want to talk about solutions, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to not be a wet blanket, but $15 an hour still doesn't cover the cost of rent in major cities, which has been increasingly, jacked up through gentrification, and also the fact that food prices have also risen tremendously, although some economists would deny that. And I also wanted to ask David if he could tell me what he thinks is going to happen when the perfect world of low interest rates and ever-rising stock prices come to an end, and actually the economy that's being created artificially by the Fed has to deal with the real economy, which is the fact that a lot of people that have jobs and a lot of people are in debt, and the student loan debt and credit card debt are amazing levels in this country.
Thank you, Harry.
Well, Harry's quite right. I mean, $15 an hour in today's dollars as a minimum wage is not certainly going to support a family very well. With two incomes, you'd have $60,000. You might do okay. But, we have these strange policies in America where we keep trying to push housing prices higher and higher. I mean, if Walmart ran on that basis, they'd go out of business. It's a very bizarre thing. This interest rate issue is, I think, going to turn out to be very important. We have been artificially propping up the banks. The value of these Fed policies to the banks, according to Bloomberg News, according to a study by two economists at, I think it's the IMF, is about $83 billion a year. That's more than food stamps were at their peak. And we ought not to be propping up banks. If you can't make it as a bank, as a commercial enterprise, then you probably ought to go out of business. We shouldn't be propping you up. you know, life goes up and down, and the choices we make in who we elect to office are going to determine what happens. And I quote Theodore Roosevelt in the book, "In the long run, we shall all rise together or fall together." And Harry's observation does make me want to point out one simple thing about the way we prop up and redistribute upward to people. I had the cover story last week in Newsweek. You can still read it online, called Corporate Deadbeats. And the subhead is, if you were taxed the way Google, Microsoft, and Apple are taxed, taxes would make you rich. Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, has a zero interest loan from the federal government through the tax system. That loan is, listen carefully, $57 billion.
Wow.
One company, not million, $57 billion. One part of it is a loan that was 34 years when I first wrote about it. It's now down to 24 years. But just imagine if you'd been able to buy a house in 1980, 34 years ago, make no payments on it until today, and then you had to pay half the price you agreed to then in today's dollars, which would be about a third of what they originally were. You'd be incredibly wealthy. Well, one reason corporations are doing so well and the rest of us aren't are these massive, subtle programs that funnel money to corporations. And every time I write about this, I get people who go, that just can't be true. And I go, well, here, it's in the public record. It's right there in front of you. And why we aren't saying to our politicians, what is going on here? Why am I subsidizing Warren Buffett, of all people, and his fellow investors? People have to understand what's happening if they want to get change, and then they've got to do the single most important thing, the only thing that really matters at the end of the day. Show up and vote.
Well,
get other people to the polls.
Well, people showed up and voted for President Obama, and I know you're highly critical of his failure to prosecute big bankers found guilty of fraud and ties to Wall Street, which directly connects to what you just talked about in terms of tax inequalities. So what do you say to people who said, well, I voted, and hasn't changed.
So vote for somebody else. President Obama basically is what would have been called when I was a young man, a liberal Republican. And he is very closely allied himself with Wall Street. He's surrounded himself with corporate people. His attorney general came from Covington and Burling, and it's very clear he's going back there because of all the people leaving justice now to go to that law firm. And their future careers depend on not prosecuting bank criminals. And we need to stop that kind of behavior. And the only way to do it is you got to elect different people, starting right at every level of government. You got to pay attention to elections and pay attention to who you vote for and contribute.
And, you know, David, President Obama said if he were around during Eisenhower's time, he would actually be considered a moderate Republican. He actually said that in an interview with CBS News.
I feel vindicated because I've been saying this for a long time.
Yes, you have. But what do you think? I mean, because, you know, now we're talking about 2016. But as you point out, any candidate that runs has to be a, quote, Wall Street candidate. So how should citizens deal with that reality?
Well, I think we need to consider a couple of, frankly, of constitutional amendments. One of them, I believe that members of Congress should be given an unlimited expense account with complete disclosure. So if you're the chairman of the Senate Health Committee and you really think you need to charter a jet to go to Tahiti to inspect the sinks behind the bar down on the beach, you go right ahead and do so. And we're going to pay the bill and the voters will know all about it and we'll kick you out of office. But instead, we have politicians sell out so cheaply. I mean, Ross Dunkowski went to jail over, what, $8,000 or $16,000. We need to put up some barriers between people who are elected to office and moneyed interests. And I think we should have complete disclosure of every meeting, you know, who are members of Congress meeting with. We should be demanding that lawmakers spend more time at home and less time in Washington. And spending time seeing people in their districts, and we should be much tougher on prosecuting conduct. I have a piece that will come out very shortly in Newsweek about a brilliant technique by which one of the states has basically legalized corruption. It's just an astonishing story of changing regulations to authorize that which shouldn't be allowed. And how many people look up changes in state regulatory books?
Wow.
You know,
Yeah.
Nobody.
Nobody. Well, we have an email from Laura who says, since our media is controlled by the 1%, which frames the reason for our woes as being caused by, quote, entitlements, Medicare, immigrants, mortgage holders, the lazy, the nanny state, on and on, how does the average harried American ever manage to figure out what's really happening to them? Politicians lie, media lies, unions are weak. Some know that should change. Some know what should change, but how are citizens going to resist in a successful way?
Well, let me challenge a little bit the listener's observation. News organizations, to get an audience, depend on having a good story. So if there's anything they're biased in favor of, it's, you know, a fight or an issue going on that will attract readers. And nobody tells people in a newsroom specifically how to do things. I mean, it would be like herding cats. It's not how it's done. You do it by the people you choose to hire and the placement of their stories. And you can take the most important – well, I mean, a good example is at the New York Times. You know, the New York Times had clearly signed on to the idea that we should invade Iraq. I found out that we were not going after Osama bin Laden's money in a serious way. The White House cut off the request for money, $12 million, and said, the American taxpayer can't afford this. And the New York Times ran the story on page C9, buried inside. But there are news organizations that are telling you the stuff you're not hearing. I mean, Newsweek is back in print, and I write for them because we're doing stuff nobody else is doing. The folks at Al Jazeera, they are, frankly, the most professional news organization I've ever dealt with in my life.
Wow.
My editor is a former philosophy professor who is an extraordinarily sophisticated thinker, a much deeper thinker than almost any editor I ever worked for. There are various other news organizations out there that are digging stuff up. The McClatchy chain, which owns the Sacramento Bee, has been doing consistently solid work on national security issues and things like that. So you may have to look a little bit for it, and you may not find it in your daily morning paper. And by the way, the biggest problem with the papers in the Bay Area is there's almost no revenue, so there's very few staff, and there's not enough time to cover things, and therefore all sorts of things don't get covered. I mean, I don't read the Chronicle anymore. I did when I was growing up. But my guess is that when the Board of Supervisors meets, there's often not a story in the paper about their meeting.
David K. Johnston is editor of the new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. David is an investigative journalist, former reporter with the New York Times. He won a 2001 Pulitzer Prize for uncovering loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. He also writes a column for Al Jazeera America, writes for Newsweek, and teaches at Syracuse University College of Law. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about our growing inequality, economic problems, possible solutions, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We've got full lines and a bunch of emails, so we'll try to go through as many as we can. Let's hear from Ryan in San Jose. Hi, Ryan. Hello, Ryan.
Hello?
Yes, hi, go ahead.
Hi, an earlier caller mentioned the idea of if you could, you know, take some money from the top 1%, redistribute to the bottom 20%, it would stimulate the economy. You talked about one method to do that, which is raising the minimum wage. Another one is a wealth tax. Imagine you take any wealth someone has over $1 million a year or something like that, you siphon off some of it every year, kind of a use it or lose it policy to keep the money flowing through the economy constantly. And that would keep money in people's pockets as well. I know it's pretty hard to implement without strong international cooperation, but I was wondering what David's thoughts were about that particular idea.
Wealth taxes have all sorts of unintended negative consequences. I'm doing a project where I'm currently rewriting part of the U.S. tax code, and I'm going to hopefully, if I can raise the money, I will rewrite the entire U.S. tax code and shrink it down from 5,300 pages to around 200 or 300, maybe 500 pages. But there are other things we can do. I mean, we have this 1986 law called Section 531 that allows corporations to siphon money out of the United States and plant it overseas. And there's an absolute minimum of $2 trillion and possibly as much as $4 trillion that's been siphoned out of the country that way. That's damaging our economy. Congress can fix that in 2 seconds. We can do a whole variety of other actions. The single biggest thing we could do is what all of our economic competitors do. They all have unions. We require Japan to have unions under the constitution that we wrote for Japan and that was put forth by that great American liberal, General Douglas MacArthur. And for those who may be too young to know, MacArthur was certainly not by any means a liberal, but he knew that if Japan had unions, it would be a more democratic society, a less warlike society. In Germany, executives have unions. If we get back unions and therefore bargaining power for workers, that is, if we restore market economics to the labor market instead of plutocrat economics, that alone would dramatically improve our country's economy.
How do you see that shifting in the future, David?
I actually think we can get back unions. We just saw, for example, American Airlines was very anti-union. It merged with U.S. Airways. And there's news this morning that overwhelmingly, something like 9,000 plus of the 11,000 gate and reservation agents of the combined airline voted to join a union. If we have honest rules that let people join unions and we stop these rules that allow corporations to fire all the union organizers and the rules actually can financially reward them for doing so, we can get back unions. And they're absolutely crucial because unions represent market economics. They represent people having bargaining power. Doesn't mean unions are perfect. They're not. But if all of our competitors have unions and do well, if Germany can have unions at the executive level, if everybody in Japan belongs to union, guess what? We can have that system too, and we will end up with a more equitable, more democratic, financially healthier society.
David K. Johnston is an investigative reporter and author of Divided. He edited the book. It's a collection of essays by a number of people who are very familiar to you. Studs Terkel, Barbara Ehrenreich, Gary Rivlin, Joseph Stiglitz, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and President Obama. Divided, the perils of our growing inequality. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And thanks for calling in, Ryan. Let's go to Andrea in Santa Cruz. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Rose. It's so good to hear your voice. It's been a while. And I love Mr. Johnston. I've read his first book, That Free Lunch. Very interesting. What a great man and everything he stands for. I got to tell you, here in Santa Cruz, you know, I'm still living in this motel. I get $961 a month in disability, and my rent's $850. I can't use my housing voucher at the motel. So I struggle every day to eat. My case manager and my advocate from Central Coast Alliance have been feeding me out of their own pocket just so I don't starve to death. But, Rose, I'm going to leave you some personal information for my case manager. If people out there in the public, if anybody's willing to send me any, like, gift cards to go to Trader Joe's or shopping at Safeway, I'd really appreciate it. But I'm struggling, and I'm really glad that Mr. Johnson's on your show today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Andrea. Stay on the line, and we'll get your information, and thank you so much for calling in. David, what about the segment of the population that we don't often see in the national media, people like Andrea who cannot make ends meet? I mean, $961
well,
a month.
This is a very important issue. You know, we have people who become disabled, for example, through workplace injuries. My brother is one of those people. He was a manual laborer. And when he originally went on disability, he's supposed to live on $800 a month. And then I think they took about $120, maybe $160 of that for his Medicare after 2 years. You can't live on that kind of money. It is cruel. It is indefensible. And when you raise this with some of the conservative Republicans, they will tell you, and some conservative Democrats, you know, that, well, these people are on drugs or they're alcoholics or whatever. No, we need to have a system that recognizes that people get hurt. And we also need to stop what's going on with the NFL. The NFL has this settlement before a judge in Philadelphia where they're going to pay what sounds like a lot of money, $765 million. There are going to be billions of dollars of medical costs for brain injuries to football players, and they're going to shove it onto the taxpayers through the Medicare system. Hmm. Absolutely wrong. They should pay 100 cents on the dollar, and we do absolutely need to have a disability system that recognizes that when people cannot work, they're still entitled to a minimal decent living, and $900 a month is not it, even if you live in, you know, middle of nowhere Nebraska.
That angle of the NFL has has not been getting attention in light of the domestic violence stories that are springing up, also child abuse. What are your thoughts about this bill that would end the NFL's tax-exempt status because of the Redskins' name? You often talk about stadiums and how they're paid for and also the tax-exempt status. Most people don't know that the NFL is tax-exempt.
Well, it's not the teams. It's the trade association. All trade associations are tax-exempt, but Roger Goodell gets $44 million a year. That strikes me as a little different than your normal thought of a trade association. And I have suggested in columns I've written that if the Washington Redskins name is not offensive to the owner of the team, he really should pick a name that is more in tune with the history of our nation's capital. And therefore, I would recommend renaming the team the Washington Slaves.
David K. Johnston is editor of the book Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And that bill is being introduced by Senator Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington. We've got just about 5 minutes left. Let's go to a few more calls. Let's hear from Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. The question I have is in regard to the value that the CEOs and the 1% tend to put on their what they're worth. To me, it just doesn't seem possible that they can do enough in a year to validate the kind of money they're making. And when it's brought up, they raise their hands, you know, like an innocent child and say, that's what the market's telling me I can earn. But to me, that's ridiculous because they control the market through the way, through their lobbying, through the way they control government regulations, through the media. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, I tend to be a little cynical that anything can be done because the whole playing game seems to be somewhat fixed.
Well, thank you. We're getting a lot of emails like this, David. How can we affect policies when politicians are so captured by money?
The answer to that is we can solve any problem we have. And if you don't believe that, then you really believe we need to have a revolution. And I certainly don't want to see that. Look, we have a constitution that enshrines slavery. We got rid of it. It took 638,000 people's deaths, about 40,000 of them black Americans, but we got rid of slavery. More than 100 years ago, when the effort to stop child labor law was going on, the Jerry Falwells of the day were going around saying that, you know, you're agents of the devil if you support child labor laws because God intends these children to work in the factories. We got child labor laws. We got environmental laws. We got all sorts of other laws. Women got back the right to vote in this country, even though neither Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Susan B. Anthony lived long enough to see it happen. We can fix these things, but people have to get organized and work at it. And it's difficult to do, and especially when it takes two incomes. And I appreciate that it's very difficult to do. But we can solve these problems. We need to produce leaders who will take this message. Elizabeth Warren is a terrific example of that kind of a leader. She's not going to do anything more than the U.S. Senate, but there are other people like that, and we need to nurture them and support them and create a different set of rules so that we get a society that works for all of us. Because after all, what's the point of the country if it's not to alleviate misery and, as the preamble of the Constitution says, establish justice and promote the general welfare? And in the original, there's a capital W in welfare.
What about citizen action? There's a huge climate march happening in New York and across the country this weekend. You know, people in California are they're taking a lot of moves on fracking. I mean, there's just so many different issues. But on the issue of inequality in the economy, what is most effective for citizens? What results in real change, would you say?
Voting out of office the people who are working against your interests. You know, the California legislature is full of people who every day work against your interests. And it's one of the legacies of Prop 13, which concentrated all the power in Sacramento and took away the duties of the financial responsibilities of school boards and county supervisors and city councils. I mean, at the end of the day, we choose through the people we elect to office. And you know, we need to vote people out of office. We need to make sure that we don't have governors who appoint to the Public Utilities Commission people like we have now who come from the industry and operate not as guardians of the public interest and balancing interests, but act as tools of the industry they came from.
David K. Johnston points out in his book that income inequality is now higher than it was in 1928, but it does not have to be this way. Change is more than possible. We can choose to restore broad prosperity instead of promoting highly concentrated prosperity and deepening poverty, especially child poverty. David K. Johnston is editor of the new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. He's a longtime investigative journalist. You can find his work. He writes for Newsweek and Al Jazeera America at yourcallradio.org. And David, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, and I hope donors support you so that they continue to hear the kind of news that they're not getting enough of from the commercial media.
Thank you. Thank you so much, David, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.